Welcome to Looks Like New, a show that asks old questions about new technology, brought to you by the Media Economies and Design Lab at CU Boulder. I'm your host, Stephanie Abdallah, and joining me on the program today is Dr. Timnit Gebru, who is the founder and executive director of the Distributed AI Research Institute, DARE for short, an independent organization of academics, activists, and engineers who believe in technology that benefits everyone. Dr. Gebru is also the co-founder of Black in AI, a nonprofit that works to increase the presence, inclusion, visibility, and health of Black people in the field of AI, and is on the board of Addis Coder, a nonprofit dedicated to teaching algorithms and computer programming to Ethiopian and Jamaican high school students. She has received a number of accolades, including being named one of nature's 10 people who have helped shape science and one of Time 100's most influential people. She is currently writing The View from Somewhere, a memoir plus manifesto, arguing for a technological future that serves our communities instead of one that is used for surveillance, warfare, and the centralization of power by Silicon Valley. Our conversation today will focus on AI ethics, the history of the AGI movement, and movements of resistance that can lead us to alternative AI futures. Dr. Gebru, it's an honor to have you with us today. Welcome to Looks Like New.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Gebru, one thing that I didn't include in the intro of this episode, but that I'd love to discuss with you, is the fact that 1 year before you founded DARE, in December of 2020, you were fired from Google, where you served as a co-lead of the ethical AI research team for raising issues of discrimination in the workplace. Could you please share how this experience led to the work you're developing now and what motivated you to research AI ethics in the first place?
So the work that I'm doing now is basically work that I tried to do in many other places beforehand. And so I founded DARE by necessity because I realized that there was certainly no idea of me doing that kind of work at Google or places like it, because I tried and I got fired. I saw the incentive structures in academia and how it would have been difficult for me to do that kind of work. This is not my experience as a PhD student. It's not something I talk about very much. But, you know, if I were to be in an academic institution having the kind of work that I'm doing, there were a few things that I thought weren't going to be good. One is that I would have to be in a box. So if I'm in computer vision and I want to get tenure there, I need to make the computer vision people happy. Well, you don't do that by questioning whether the field should even exist in the first place. Or I have to decide to be in some other kind of department. And also there's the whole publish or perish kind of paradigm, where that I explicitly want to work against, because I don't think you can do good research under a paradigm where you have to push out papers all the time. It is also bad for kind of relationships. So we have community-based relationships. We have these seven principles in our research philosophy, and one of them says trust and time. So we are saying that good work requires trust and time, and especially if we want to partner with organizations or people who are not abiding by the academic incentive structure. So, and if we have to abide by that incentive structure, then we're going to be very harmful to those people. So, you know, I knew I couldn't do my work in an academic setting, or at least, you know, academic setting as I knew. And I tried to do the work at Google, but then I got fired because I was, the reason I got fired was many reasons, actually. But the icing on the cake, as they would call it, is an academic paper I wrote about the dangers of large language models. And so this was in 2020, and large language models weren't something spoken about in the mainstream because we hadn't had ChatGPT yet or Claude or any of these chatbots. But I was seeing how there was a race to just build larger and larger language models, large both in the size of the model and in the data set, the size of the data that is being used to train such models. And I was asking them why. Basically, you know, it's a mine is bigger than yours kind of race. And I didn't understand why we needed to do it. And so I actually, you know, wrote a paper about it. Everybody knew that I was writing such a paper. And then I guess once they saw it, they wanted us to retract this paper. And I didn't want to agree to retracting or taking even my name off of the paper without certain conditions. The first question is, if I'm going to have a team of people doing critical work and they're considered academic researchers at Google, they need to know and I need to know what the parameters of the work that we can do are. You know, do we expect that anybody can just censor our work at any time? In which case, we should not be in a research department. We should be in like a marketing department because we would be using our stature in the field to kind of distort the state of the lay of the land in terms of what the harms and risks of technology are. And so I just really couldn't bring myself to do that. So they fired me and they said that I had resigned, which, you know, I hadn't yet anyway. So, you know, a few months I had to kind of fight that battle because then they fired my co-lead. They were harassing my team. And I was very worried that, you know, they were going to do more things to the people who are supporting me. My team was very vocal. But then after that, I started thinking about, you know, where could I do this work? And also, what are the constraints that I had before that I didn't need to work under? So one of the constraints that I had is that, for example, there were people that I just could not hire in any of these other places that I was in. For example, activists or people who have not like a college level education or postgraduate degrees or anything like that, but have like a PhD with their life experiences with certain things. Like we have a refugee advocate who's single-handedly rescued 16,000 plus refugees from human trafficking. Wow. We have people who were worked at Amazon like as delivery drivers. And so knew firsthand the algorithmic control. So these were the kinds of people I wanted to hire, but I couldn't in any of these other environments, right? Because, you know, there's all this talk about benefiting humanity, but, you know, if you are not working with people who are already doing that, then you're not going to benefit humanity. So the second thing I wanted to do was I didn't want my team to be located in Silicon Valley. I wanted to have a team that didn't need to be uprooted from wherever they were to work on technology or to influence the trajectory of technology. So that was the first word that came to my mind was the word distributed. And of course, the other words are like AI Research Institute. So we were doing AI research, but from many different standpoints. The two things that are important to me are, one, of course, we have to uncover, mitigate, and ideally eliminate the harms of these current so-called AI systems that we're all dealing with. But I don't think we want to be stuck just kind of telling other people what not to do, right? We have to also put forward our vision of what a positive technological future is, according to us. And so that's our second pillar at DARE, is to imagine and execute on a technological future that we believe actually benefits our communities.
Thank you so much for this introduction, and I really appreciate you contextualizing the work that you're currently doing at DARE. And so I'm curious to understand, having researched AI ethics from both sides of the spectrum, let's put it that way, for a multinational company and then now for a nonprofit focused on community-rooted research, what would you say are the main differences in doing this sort of research? And are there points of convergence that could be further explored to advance high-quality AI research?
That's a very interesting question. So when you're working at a multinational corporation, there is a limit to what you can say. And when I was at Google, there was still some kind of debate about whether or not it was possible to do that kind of work in a multinational corporation. I remember there was a paper called The Gray Hoodie Project, and I don't remember if the paper came out before or after I was fired. I think it came out after I was fired, or right around the time. And it was by Mohammed and Mustafa Abdallah, I believe. And they were talking about how corporations, tech companies, big tech, were using the same tactics as big tobacco to influence a discourse about the harms of their technologies. And the way what were these tactics? These tactics were funding academic conferences, funding academics, and so therefore influencing what kind of stuff could be researched, and also how that the research is communicated. And at that time, I was able to do some kind of work, like when I was at Microsoft before that as a postdoc, my collaborator and I had released a paper showing that face recognition systems on the market, including Microsoft's, had much higher error rates for darker-skinned women than everybody else. And when I was at Microsoft, they didn't respond by firing me or doing anything like that. Actually, at Microsoft Research, they highlighted that work, which was very interesting, because Microsoft Research operated semi-independently from the rest of Microsoft, which also gives researchers the illusion. I was thinking about this because at Google, of course, I got fired. But the Microsoft can also use its researchers doing fairness or ethics or something like that as a shield against any kind of criticism it can get. It could be like Microsoft can use its researchers as a shield against criticism, because if you criticize something they're doing, they can say, oh, we have these great researchers working on fairness or working on ethics, and we don't fire them. They have, complete independence. So you can have a situation where the research arm is saying something, one thing, and of course the company is not following whatever they're saying, right? And then on the flip side, you have a place like Google where the researchers were saying something and the company, of course, fired them. So I think both ends can be used to whitewash what the companies are doing. But that was what happened when I was at Microsoft. And so I thought, okay, maybe I could, do some of this work. Maybe at a minimum, I could create a team that other people wouldn't create, fight for people that other people wouldn't fight for. And so that's kind of what I did. But of course, it became clear that there was a limit to what I could do. And if most of your academics, your researchers doing this kind of work are housed in these kinds of places, then they would distort the reality, right? Because they wouldn't be able to say certain things. And so I think that's not good. So at the same time, if we don't have people like this in these tech companies, we also wouldn't know what's brewing before it does. So I still think it's important to have people as whistleblowers or people there who can organize, because oftentimes you'll see what's coming before it happens. I saw what was coming with large language models before it was all over the place, right? So it's important, I think, to have these kinds of people. So that could be one point of convergence. Another unfortunate point of convergence, I'll say, is, I would say I have a lot of independence right now as a nonprofit, and I'm very grateful. Most of my funders just are funding my vision. Like, I don't really have to contort myself into anything. But we can't forget that the nonprofit is basically a nonprofit industrial complex, right? And so all of the leaders hang out in the same places. Like, you go to Davos, you'll have the leaders of the nonprofit people hanging out with, like, Sundar and Dario or whatever, hanging out with the Pope. I don't know. It's all the same people, same elites kind of charting the world's future. So whether you're in the nonprofit or the for-profit world, you have to fight that. And some nonprofits are explicitly created to whitewash the crimes of the funders in the for-profit world. Like, Google funds a whole bunch of so-called organizations, justice organizations, just so that, of course, the money that they give is not, that much compared to the actual money that they're spending on the harms. But so the nonprofit worlds can be used similarly to whitewash harms and crimes. And so whether you're in the for-profit world or the nonprofit world, you still have to be attuned to those kinds of issues.
Thank you so much. This was illuminating for me because I think it's, especially to your last point, I think it's something that most people who are not working on the field might not be aware of, right? There's this tendency of place nonprofits in very different standards and places that then in comparison to for-profits. And I think it's important to understand this conversion, as you mentioned, so we're more aware of the work that we're going to support, of the kind of work that we want to help promote, and et cetera, right? And one thing that you mentioned in your in the first question I asked was about futures. And I definitely want to talk more about that. But I feel like in order to do so, we kind of have to step into the past a little bit. And one thing that you mention quite often is about the history of AGI, which is the short for Artificial General Intelligence. It has clearly captured the public's imagination, leading us to discuss what I understand as two very opposite future scenarios that come from the same idea that AGI can do any task under any circumstance. And one of these scenarios would be very utopic, and the other scenario is quite apocalyptic. And in your work, you urge us to look back into the history of the AGI movement to understand how we got to where we are today. So I was hoping you could talk more about this history and the answers that it provides us about our present relations with AGI.
Yeah, you know, I'm not a historian, but I just had to understand what's going on, because that would also inform what I'm for and what I'm against. And I needed to understand why everybody was just chasing after this idea of creating as large a model as possible. I just could not understand. You know, it was all of a sudden the only thing everybody was talking about. So when I was a PhD student, AGI was not a mainstream topic. Like, people talking about AGI, even luminaries in AI were just sort of like roll their eyes when, you know, Elon Musk was talking about how we're quote unquote summoning the devil in 2013-14, and other people would just sort of roll their eyes. So so the biggest point of inflection for AGI was when OpenAI was founded, ironically, as a nonprofit. And It also makes our point about the nonprofit and for-profit worlds, how they're not very different, is that I wrote an open letter, I remember, when OpenAI was founded, and I kept it to myself in the beginning because I was very angry by how the press was describing OpenAI as a kind of endeavor by all these men like Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and Sam Altman, all these billionaires who were so concerned about the future of humanity, and they were very concerned about AI destroying humanity, and that's all these people talked about. And it was all over the news. And at the same time, like in 2015, there was a letter similar to this very recent Pause AI letter that the Future of Humanity Institute, another organization in that crew, where they were worried about AI destroying humanity, but at the same time, they were like, but at the same time, we know that AI can eradicate poverty and, you know, solve climate change and, you know, cure all these diseases, but also it can destroy humanity. I'm like, okay, so it's just like, how does it solve poverty? Like, you're a billionaire, you can solve poverty. Like, just give your money. I mean, really, a couple of these billionaires could single-handedly solve poverty, right?
Yeah.
But they have to put money into AI to do that. So this whole thing was just very, very irritating for me at the time. So, but at the same time, you know, like I said, this whole AGI talk was not mainstream. But it became more and more mainstream with OpenAI. And by the time the whole large language models thing came out and ChatGPT was like, everybody had to redirect to talk about AGI, and even the NSF had some joint call with some of these organizations. So I saw and a parallel kind of history there is that I first got introduced to the effective altruism movement in like 2012 or something, And so the effective altruism movement, I remember for one of their keynotes, they invited Peter Thiel. And I talked to someone and they told me that, you know, they're working on AI. Like, they think that the most important thing to work on was AI. And this was like in 2013 or something. And I was working in AI, but I didn't understand why that was the – I mean, I was interested in it, you know, but, like, I couldn't convince anybody that this was the most important thing to work on in the world. And so I didn't understand why, like, an organization talking about being effectively altruistic or whatever is redirecting to that. And then they invited Peter Thiel to their conference as a keynote speaker. And I was just like, what does this have to do with altruism? I don't understand. But he was also telling them, like, working on AI is one of the most important things because it can be, like, transformative, right? Utopia or dystopia, apocalyptic. And they can make sure that they get the utopian side rather than the apocalyptic side, right?
Of course they can.
Yeah. And so this is ridiculous. Like, I just rolled my eyes and I kind of continued on. But by the time it was like 2022 or something after I got fired from Google, I couldn't just roll my eyes and continuing on because effective altruism was everywhere. And they were pushing all of these AI institutes. And they were also very involved in the founding of OpenAI. A lot of OpenAI people were effective altruists. And then a bunch of effective altruists who didn't think OpenAI was effective altruist enough left and founded Anthropic, which was now being billed as the more ethical alternative to OpenAI, just like OpenAI was billed as the more ethical alternative to Google. So then I had to be like, what is going on? And the way they talked about stuff sounded like eugenics-y to me. Like, it had the smell of eugenics, but I couldn't quite put my finger in it. Like, the way they kind of, you know, had these grand ambitions. Like, well, you know, the reason we need to work on AI is because even if there's like a 0.00000001% chance that it'll destroy all of humanity, in the future there's going to be a lot of humanity. So even that small chance needs to be eliminated. So that is the most important thing to work on. And I'm like, okay, this is like the saying, you know, you got to break a few eggs to make an omelet kind of situation. Because then nothing you say to criticize anything they're doing is enough because, no, like, they're working on this important grand thing to save humanity. So at the same time, I started coming across Emil Torres's work talking about long-termism. And at the time, I didn't know. I had been introduced to these ideas, but I didn't know that they were called long-termism. And so this is the idea that in the long term, you'll have like 10 to the 50 humans or whatever colonizing space and stuff like that. And so doing anything that removes them from existence is a crime right now. So it's better for 1 million people to die right now than like 1 billion people then to die, right? So if 1 million people die right now to prevent 1 billion people from dying, then, like, you know, it's okay kind of thing. So I kind of put two and two together and I realized, like, we were reading up on all these topics and I realized that the whole idea of AGI is very connected, stems from the eugenics movement. And so the effective altruists are, like, interconnected with these the long-termists. There's one called the rationalists, and the transhumanism is a big thing. And so the people who wanted to make AGI mainstream were explicitly, like, transhumanists, and they called it transhuman AGI. And their goal is basically to have people upload their brains to computers. So you instead of, like, you as a human, you're like a, you don't exist. They don't want humans basically anymore, right? They want a digital being that they think is better than humans. So it's kind of a more radical form of eugenics. Eugenics is about improving, so-called improving human species, whereas this one is getting rid of the human species altogether and having a better new species that never feels pain, that lives forever, that colonizes all of the cosmos. They call it paradise engineering. So one of these guys who wrote this, who compiled the first book on AGI, Ben Gortzel, he's actually in the Epstein files, FYI. Surprise, surprise. Anyhow, that's an aside. And a lot of these other people were in that book, like the co-founder of DeepMind, who apparently came up with the word AGI, or, you know, a whole bunch of other people. And so we were working on this, and we coined the term Tusk Reel to connect all of these different ideologies, transhumanism, extropian, similar, effective altruism, long-termism, the people, the singularitarians, you know, the people who say that singularity is near. It's a very, like, it's like a secular religion, right? They believe that in eschatology, meaning end of times, either you'll go, you know, either it's going to be utopia or dystopia, and any day now, the end is near kind of thing. That's the singularity. And so the thing that's interesting is, the thing that's interesting is that to me, both the utopia and apocalyptic visions are two sides of the same coin. Because the idea is, yes, we have to build this thing because we're going to get utopia, but we have to build it in the right way so that you don't get the apocalyptic side. China can get the apocalyptic side. If you regulate us too much, like OpenAI right now was asking the U.S. government to fast-track certain nuclear power plans and things like that, because guess what? We need to win, and we need to build the utopian kind of AGI, don't let China do it kind of thing. So it's both the same kind of narrative, the same people flip-flop between utopian and dystopian side. So the reason it's really important to understand this history is because new computer science students or students in technology in general come in and they just hear this term AGI being thrown around, and now they hear these CEOs being platformed on, like, mainstream news, like 60 Minutes and stuff, talking about how they're going to cure cancer with no evidence, or solve climate change when they're actually destroying the environment, which absolutely makes no sense. These students might think it was almost like a law of nature that we would be here, that eventually someone will build AGI, eventually large language models and this kind of chatbots would exist. But it's good to understand that what we're living in right now is the highly resourced, ridiculous fantasy of a bunch of billionaires who managed to push this fantasy into the mainstream, and they worked hard to push it into the mainstream. And it's not based on ideals that most people, I believe, would be behind. Most people are not behind eugenics, but they don't know that there's this eugenics connection, because the transhumanism was coined by the founder of the British eugenics, president of the British Eugenics Society, right? This is not like a loose connection. I think this was important for me too, because then I can think about, okay, what are values I'm not behind? You know, these people care about colonizing the cosmos. Like, I don't want to colonize anything. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's not my goal. We can coexist with many different forms of life. Like, I'm not interested in having a superior, like, transhuman or posthuman or something like that, right? And I'm not interested in having a couple of vanguards that give us a machine god. I'm not interested in building such a thing. So it's good to know that history, just to understand that, you know, we didn't have to be this way. And there are many different paths in forward, and there could have been many different paths, but we chose to platform these kinds of ideas. And because these people have so much money, they got these ideas resourced. They conned their way, a so-called nonprofit, into building these kinds of systems that are exploitative, that are killing the environment, stealing data, deceiving the public. And the press, unfortunately, was not doing their jobs because they were sort of fawning all over them. They were doing what I call press release as a service. And the academics were not doing their jobs because all of a sudden the field you've been working on forever is all over the news. It's hyped. You're getting a lot of money. You're not grounding the public into what's real and what's not real. So to me, that's why we're here.
Absolutely. And I appreciate this very important and necessary recap of our past. And I think considering how entrenched, as you mentioned, the AGI movement is with eugenics, how are initiatives such as Black in AI and ADIS Coder contributing to changing the future history of this movement? And could these initiatives be a way to escape this utopic/apocalyptic dichotomy that is created about the future of AGI?
That's a good question. I mean, I think these initiatives are a little different because, for example, a decoder is a coding and algorithms camp for very young people, like high school kids. And so we're introducing them these concepts in high school, and like we're introducing them to computer science, many of them for the first time, and learning how to think logically and things like this. And the thing that's dangerous is that once we introduce these students to these concepts, and then if what they do is just go to school, college, do the right thing, get the right grades, etc., I think they're just going to end up believing in this hype and in the same kind of system. So the intervention has to be constant. Same with Black and AI. It's the way when I founded it, it was a professional organization to help people. And so, you know, to make sure that people in the field with different a point of view that might not be popular at the time, or people who are experiencing discrimination, people who are at the verge of like quitting, would stay. And that can make a difference. Like, what, for example, Deb Raji is someone who told me that she was about to quit the tech industry when I flagged her for Black and AI to come to our workshop. She stayed. She had a good time. She had a network of people. And then she collaborated with Joy Bulamini to show that Amazon had a similar kind of error rate in face recognition systems that me and Joy had shown. So Amazon's face recognition system was had a much higher error rate for darker-skinned women than everybody else. And then we sort of – they published that paper. It was very – it was on the front page of a lot of newspapers, and Amazon was, like, trying to discredit it. And me and my – this was when I was at Google. So me and my colleague Meg wrote, like, a letter anonymously, got a whole bunch of people to very, you know, famous people, luminaries in the field, to sign the letter at telling Amazon that they're wrong and asking them to stop selling their face recognition systems to police. That was on the news. And, you know, with the Black Lives Matter movement, 1 year later, they announced a 1 year moratorium, etc. So I think it's kind of a snowball movement, right? If Deb had quit, you know, if Deb hadn't found Black and AI, maybe she would have quit, and then this kind of work may not have happened. But at the same time, I don't think it's sufficient, because it's not sufficient to have people from marginalized communities stay in a specific system if they're not having a ways to do things differently. Like, if you go to a specific school, you learn a specific curriculum, you can still end up working at Palantir, or you can still end up working at OpenAI, because A, there may not be many other options. That might be the only way as a tech, as an engineer or other somebody else in tech to work. You might only have these options. Or B, you're being educated in the status quo. And so the educational system has to change, right? So we have to have resources to educate people differently, because just because from a specific background, they're not going to have this kind of point of view, because everything around them is telling them different.
Absolutely. And these many examples that you're bringing up demonstrate to me the laborious effort that people of color and also from the Global South have been dedicating to shaping alternative AI futures, right? But it seems like it has to be a more collective sort of project. So in your opinion, who else should be invested in these futures? And is there any way for big tech to get responsibly involved?
Well, big tech does not have any incentives to get responsibly involved. So I've been there, done that, like, in trying to do it. And so I just don't think my role anymore is to try to do that. I think they have to be forced to do it, because the thing is that they only answer to the stock market. And even if you had a CEO who wants to do the right thing, and then if they do the right thing and then the stock analysts believe something different and then the stock goes down, the CEO is going to get fired. So really, there's just like no incentive for them to do something differently unless the market forces them to do it. And how is the market going to force them to do it? Law, some kind of law forces them to do it. Workers force them to do it, because without our labor, nobody can do anything. So I always believe in the work and the labor movement, because the labor movement has a lot of power to change things. And so I think these are the kinds of things I believe in with respect to big tech. They have to be forced to change. They're not going to do it of their own volition. I'm really interested in resourcing the imagination of not the billionaires, but like, what would it look like if you were to resource the imagination of someone who was harmed by AI right now? And like, what kind of tech would they want? Or the artists who people are claiming can be replaced by these machines, which is, for anyone who knows what art or music or any of these things are, I think that's such a sad statement. To me, that statement's come from a joyless, like, person, you know, who hasn't felt the joy that these kinds of artistic, creative spaces bring. So I'm interested in that, you know. Okay, so if the resourcing of these individuals is what brought us here, what would we get if we resourced the imaginations of other people? And these other people have to be people. So sometimes what happens in the conversations about AI and the global majority population is about how we're being left behind, or how, like, it's the fourth industrial revolution and ChatGPT doesn't even speak our language. Like, do we want ChatGPT to speak our language, right?
I don't.
Exactly. And so, you know, my hope is that if people understand how so-called ChatGPT even came to be, they'd be like, we want to build something different. This is not what we want to do. And I'm interested in resourcing those kind of people and what they want to build. Right? Because if we don't change the narrative, then even when we're supporting people, come to the table, they're going to come to a table that's already set, you know, and they're not going to be able to change things, because it's kind of like the papers I was allowed to write while at Google versus not, right? Like, you're able to change things within a certain narrative. Oh, if it's making ChatGPT more inclusive or something, that'll be like the conversation will just be limited in that way, rather than what other tech can we build? Like, what is the something else that we want to build instead?
Awesome. Thank you for that explanation. And I think it leaves an invitation there for anyone really interested in doing this sort of work to maybe get a hold of who else is interested in fostering these alternative imaginations that you're mentioning. And a huge focus of your work at DARE is on small, constrained, task-specific models that outperform, as you mentioned before, one-size-fits-all trend of building machine learning-based models. So based on your research outcomes, how can rethinking scale be a solution to the current challenges we're experiencing with bigger models? And what are other aspects of machine learning that we must rethink?
You know, when I was at Google, my then direct report, Alex, who's now my director of research at DARE, wrote this short paper with Tina Park called Against Scale. It was approved and everything, but it kind of summarizes some of my ideas too, because in reality, even if we are if we care about so-called scale, the way change happens is by people doing constrained, contextually specific, task specific things. So if you look at a movement, it's not like a movement just happens all over the world all at once. It's like it starts with a group of people somewhere, even universities, one classroom, and then one university, and then other universities, and then like other spaces, and then other countries. And like that's how movements spread, right? So when I think about Black and AI, you know, I wanted to start something that was very specific to the context I knew, because I knew the issues. I knew what I wanted to change, what kind of environment I wanted for myself. So I did that. Once we created Black in AI, there was Latinx in AI, there was queer in AI. I think now there's Muslims in AI. There's like a whole bunch of organizations. And then there was also like other organizations like Black in X, Black in Neuro, Black in Physics, Black, you know. And so to me, that is kind of that is scale. It's an impact across scale. But it was done by me creating one organization, other people kind of being inspired to do that for their own context. So that's how I approach anything in life, anything in your work. Even if you're interested in scale, you just, first of all, you can't even measure progress unless it's a small environment, an environment that you know. You can't even know whether you're doing well or not if you're trying to, like, build a worldwide movement for everybody, for everything. So why do we think we can do models like that? I mean, we already know life is not like that. So how is it that you can build a machine god? Like, how do you know whether it works or not? And also, why do we want it to work? Why would I want OpenAI to achieve a model that can be your therapist and your teacher and your translator and your tutor? Like, why do I want OpenAI to amass this kind of money and power? I don't like this world, even though I know they can't do that, but I also don't want them to be able to do that. So if we're thinking about, like, what our values are, if my goal is to have many people around the world have power, and instead of having this one company in Silicon Valley have all this power, well, I want to be able to have many different smaller companies who are able to build smaller different kinds of models and hire different kinds of people who can also contribute to their local economies and local people. That's what I want, right? So, like at DARE, we're incubating this federation called the Honiki Federation of Small Language Technology Startups. And the idea is, if you're a small company that is focused on a few Ethiopian languages and you're a small company focused on a few Ghanaian languages or something like that, instead of trying to be a monopoly and focus on all, you know, thousands of languages, you do a really good job on your own languages that you know of, and you'll do a better job because you know the context, you know the people, you know the political environment you're working in. You do a good job, and you can sort of band together if you want, like, bigger clients or some other advocacy or something like that, but you can continue to focus on your own context that you know instead of trying to be a monopoly. And the thing is, I think what's missing in an engineering kind of conversation or education usually is how incentives are the things that lead to specific outcomes. Like, what research is even pursued? Big tech is not going to pursue research that, you know, uses a small amount of data, because that's what their advantage is. They think their advantage is them having all of the data and you having none of it. Why will they, like, why are they incentivized to have you create a method where, you know, you do the same thing they're doing or with a small amount of, you know, resources, right? So our engineering kind of curriculum and other kind of tech curriculum have to show people how incentives lead to certain outcomes. And then, so when technologists want to do something differently, so that they also consider, okay, how different do the incentives have to be now? You know, how do I change it? So now when we think about incentives, you think about the venture capitalist system. The venture capitalist system, its incentive is to have a company grow as much as possible and be a monopoly. They do not support, they call them, like, lifestyle businesses, right? If you're a business and you're doing well, you have revenue that sustains you, that's not, venture capitalists don't like that. You have to show them how you're going to be a billion-dollar business, monopolize everybody, because they make money either when you IPO or you sell to another. So now we have to think, okay, this incentive is leading to certain kinds of horrible, you know, outcomes in companies. If we want people to do something different, we need to create a different incentive for them, an alternative for them. We can't just tell them to do something differently, right? I tell you to do something different and still your only option is raising VC money, I'm setting you up for failure, right? So when we are talking about how we want things to be different, we also have to give alternatives for them to actualize how they can do things differently.
Are there examples of alternative incentives already in place that you could help us to illustrate what
it could be? So, for example, this Honiki Federation I was talking about is an alternative I'm trying to create, right? So for the example being, so you have all of these smaller organizations and the hype. So when OpenAI comes up with some kind of model Or there was one example I'm planning on giving on my talk, actually. Facebook comes with, or Meta comes up with a, they claim to have one language that does language translation across 200 languages and state-of-the-art, et cetera. One model that does all this stuff. Now, companies that are focused on each of those languages, people come to them and they say, oh, sorry, like, you're just one little company. Facebook has solved it. You know, you should close up shop, right? But it's not true because this one little company does a lot higher quality work than one of, and, you know, languages that Facebook does. So, but the other problem is if this company is looking for clients to sustain itself as a business, a number of times I've heard from companies like this that the clients come and they say, come back to us when you have more languages. They're not, you know, rewarding them for focusing on a few languages and doing really good work. They're being incentivized. So by having a federation, the idea is the client that says, come back to us with more languages can deal with the federation because there's now more languages, even though it's not one big company. It's a federation that has maybe one API, one interface that's kind of easy for you to interface with. So that's kind of that idea came out because we were thinking about the different incentive structures and thinking about how to have a, you know, an alternative incentive structure.
This is fascinating. I really hope it works out. And I'm thinking as you talk that we're constantly making, we're constantly listing a few actors that should be taking part in this sort of initiative slash research. And these are usually technologists, engineers, researchers. And so my question is, what other sectors of society have you seen engaging in advocacy towards alternative models? And do you have any inspiring examples that you could share with us?
Well, I think that the reason I was giving examples on engineers right now is because they're being taught to do the wrong thing, and I think they should be taught to do the right thing instead. But my inspiration for people doing the right thing a lot of times does not come from engineers, right? It comes from people being trained in critically analyzing things like sociologists. I work with a bunch of sociologists, artists. Artists are at the forefront of this resistance to what's going on with AI. Like some of the artists are plaintiffs in against these image generation companies like OpenAI or Midjourney or what's the Stability AI, etc. And artists were some of the first people to ring the alarm, right? And so I have a lot of inspiration from artists who are still going because, you know, they're losing their jobs. The phrase starving artist is already a thing, and this is happening on top of it. And they're fighting tooth and nail. Like Carla Ortiz is one person I have a lot of respect for. She's a plaintiff in a number of these cases, and she tells people that it's not set yet. Don't give up. Like, don't think that this fight is set, you know? And I think with artists, they also help us have, I think they can play a huge role because one of the people who brought us here, in my opinion, the industries, is Hollywood. Hollywood's portrayal of AI hasn't been helpful for the cause, right? And if that was different, they could have a huge impact because narrative is one of the most important things here. Journalists could have a huge impact. They're not, few are doing the right thing, but many are not, like mainstream journalists. And of course, journalism is under a lot of havoc right now. And so anybody in the narrative setting stage. And this is a fight for everybody. I mean, like unions, we talk to a lot of nurses unions. We talk to the Writers Guild. I mean, that was a pretty big strike that they had in the U.S. at least, right? And I just want to say that for our, for DARE specifically, Tehuku Media has been an amazing inspiration. And this is what I mean by scale. This is an organization based out of New Zealand and interested in Maori language revitalization. Maori are the indigenous people of New Zealand. And they created this language tech system to help with language revitalization. And when an American company wanted to buy their data, license their data, they refused. And they were like, you know, you beat this language out of our grandparents, and now you want to sell it to us as a service. And then they created a platform to help other indigenous groups that speak, you know, have a smaller number of speakers of different languages, create similar technologies, you know, and they've just been a huge inspiration for us, right? And they're this one little tiny company in New Zealand. So there are a lot of people and organizations and that I think we can look to for inspiration. And this is kind of, I think, a fight for everybody.
Absolutely. And thank you for sharing these amazing examples that are out there already. Our time is almost up. But I do want to go back to something I mentioned in the introduction. You're currently writing The View from Somewhere, a memoir plus manifesto. Could you brief us on what this work is about and what other work are you hoping to continue and or start in the future?
Yeah, so I think the title is going to be different. We'll I'll tell you pretty soon once it's finalized. That was a book. I mean, I've never written a book before, and it's quite a process. But it's been actually great because it's been really good to have to write slowly and a whole book. It's very different from like posting really quickly on social media or reacting really quickly to something. It's like, you know, it's a long process, and it's something you have to think about for a long time. So that's been really great for me. This book is about my journey in tech and how I came to view things the way I view things, because I didn't always view things the way I currently view things. And so it's kind of how I had those different experiences that made me see things differently, because my education didn't lead to, you know, it wasn't designed for me to be against the status quo, right? Your education, if you go to like a prestigious school or something, it's to entrench the status quo. It's not to change it. And so it's about that and how I came to view things differently and what that viewing things differently means, like what that alternative future means to me and how I'm hoping to try and execute it. So that's the book. It's going to be very interesting once it comes out. I can't believe I was writing a whole book. It's a whole different thing, different from what I've done before. And other works that I'm looking forward to, I'm really looking forward to doing more of this alternative futures building. I really want to do that more than complaining about the status quo. I think, you know, otherwise we're always going to be in a reactionary position. So I'm looking forward to more of that work.
That's wonderful. And I really look forward to reading the book, whatever the title may be.
Thanks.
To wrap up, do you have any recommendations for people in our audience who are interested in engaging more with AI ethics and alternative futures?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you some stuff that DARE is doing and then other people. So at DARE, we have these workshops called Possible Future Workshops. I don't know when the next one is scheduled, so stay tuned for that. And it's interesting because the people who attended the first workshop created like a Discord server to discuss those kinds of things. So maybe once you attend a workshop, then we can like invite you to some stuff like that. We have a podcast called Mystery AI Hype Theater, and that's kind of busting hype. So if there's hype about therapy and ChatGPT, then we have like therapists and, you know, health professionals talking about it and just things like this. So we have different kinds of programming, I think, for people interested in different kinds of topics. Other than that, there's another podcast called, is it The Computer Something Weekly? Oh, man, I forgot. Maybe you guys will find it after the podcast. But the computer says maybe. I think it's called The Computer Says Maybe.
Perfect.
Which I like. And I'd follow works of like Ruha Benjamin and Safiya Noble, who both were here, I see, in past years. And I would just kind of, yeah, honestly, just also follow artists. Like Carla Ortiz is amazing. And just kind of expand, maybe it's good to expand our horizon or understanding of what's possible, you know, where we are versus what's possible. I know Ruha has this book called Imagination, a Manifesto.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that's kind of the kind of thinking we want to foster.
Absolutely. And thank you for the recommendations. Dr. Gebru, it's been an absolute honor to have you with us today, especially when I know your time here in Boulder, Colorado is short and quite busy. So thank you for sharing your knowledge with us. And I hope you enjoy the rest of your stay.
Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to Looks Like New on KGNU's It's the Economy. Looks Like New is a show that asks all the questions about new technology, coming to you from the Media Economies Design Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder, and is produced by Alexander Lipka. You can find us on the fourth Thursday of every month on air or online at lookslikenew.net or wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you'll join us next month. Thank you for listening.